Good morning and welcome to episode 26 of our monthly Meet the Experts Q&A sessions with Cinten's employment team. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing at Cinten's. Just very quickly for me, wanted to take the opportunity to thank you once again for all your positive comments about these sessions, for signing up to them, to tuning into them each month, obviously to send in your questions and watching the videos and listening to the podcasts afterwards. We never take your attendance for granted. And once again, we very much appreciate it. Very quickly, before I move on, just moving on the slides. As with previous months, the employment team will answer three questions and our speakers today are on the screen there in front of you, Associates Catherine Hope and Fiona Campbell. So without any further ado, questions are there. We're going to pass straight over to Catherine, who is going to start with question one. Catherine, good morning and over to you.
Thanks, David, and good morning and thank you for joining us. So question one today, this was in a redundancy, so if someone's employment is terminated by way of redundancy and they're not given that right of appeal, will it mean that any dismissal is then unfair? And that's for if someone has the acquired 2 years service to bring an unfair dismissal claim. So in brief, not necessarily, that's the answer. And it's really going to come down to whether your original selection for redundancy is in accordance with the required fair procedure. If it has been, then the absence of appeal is not going to mean that you're not going to be able to defend an unfair dismissal claim and that the dismissal would, in a sense, automatically be unfair. Well, I think when you're thinking about this question, you really have to think about what is the test for a dismissal on the grounds of redundancy to be fair when the employee has 2 years service. And here it's that you have to establish that the reason is redundancy. And secondly, as with all cases of a fair dismissal, you have to show that you've acted reasonably in all the circumstances of the case in treating redundancy as the reason for dismissing the particular employee. And in practice, that comes down to procedural fairness. Now, when you're looking at redundancy, when you're looking at procedural fairness, the key components of that are warning and consulting your employees in relation to the proposed redundancies, adopting a fair basis on which to select for redundancy, so having deciding on the appropriate pools and then having fair selection criteria to select from those pools, or if you have pools of one, that's fair that you're doing so. And finally, considering suitable alternative employment and searching for that and offering it where it's available. So I think if you're an employer and you've followed a fair procedure covering all of those requirements, then you should still be in a really strong position to defend a claim when there's been an absence of an appeal as part of that procedure. Now, it's interesting, there's actually been a recent case in the last month or so about that actually focus on this point, a Court of Appeal case. And forgive my pronunciation, but in the Gwynedd Council versus Barrett and another, there were some teachers whose positions were redundant once the school they were working at closed and a new one opened. And they weren't given the statutory and contractual right to appeal in this particular case. So they brought a claim for an unfair dismissal in the Employment Tribunal, and at first instance they were successful. And the Tribunal in the first instance said that the right to that appeal was fundamentally important, and it was fundamentally important at a crucial time in that process. And it stated that an appeal is ingrained in the principles of natural justice. And although it didn't say that the absence of appeal would render every dismissal unfair, it did say that the absence of an appeal wouldn't render dismissal unfair. It did say that it would be truly exceptional circumstances for it to be reasonable for that to be that right not to be given. So in that case, they found there weren't exceptional circumstances, and then they found that overall the dismissal was unfair. The employer in that case, so this the local authority appealed. So it ended up in the Employment Appeals Tribunal and the Court of Appeal. And they were arguing that the tribunal had erred by requiring that it had to be truly exceptional circumstances for an employee not to be given that right of appeal. Now, in this case, the Court of Appeal found that the lack of appeal was unfair, and they thought the Employment Tribunal had looked at fairness overall. So in this case, it was found to be unfair. Because in making that decision, they'd looked at that the employees hadn't had the ability to raise a complaint, so a grievance about how the procedure had been conducted. But what they did say, an important point, just looking at this question that's come up this week, is they said that, however, If it's the case that overall the procedure that's been carried out by the employer is a fair procedure, then it's not going to be the case that the lack of the right to appeal is going to be fatal. So if you've done all of those things, you've covered all of those requirements for fairness in terms of the procedural aspects, you should be in a good place to be able to defend an unfair dismissal claim. Obviously, that being said, the right to appeal is going to be one of a number of factors that will be taken into account. So in terms of this question, just going back to what I said at the start, if you have ensured that you followed a fair procedure in terms of the reason and the selection for redundancy, you should still be in a good position to defend a claim if there's not been the right of appeal. Of course, the safest always the safest option, and we would always advise that you do give that right to appeal. But if for some reason it's not practically possible or the difficulties, then it's going to be even more important that you are ensuring that you've followed a fair procedure, you've followed your selection criteria are fair. Because if you think about it, there hasn't been that opportunity for an employee to raise concerns about procedure. So if there is an issue in that, you haven't got the ability to remedy that at appeal. But in the alternative, if there aren't grounds for appeal, then that's when you're going to be in a strong position to defend an unfair dismissal claim. So that's just that question in brief. And then I'll pass you over to Fiona, who's going to look at our second question.
Thanks, Catherine. So my question this morning is, should an employer who has a practice of giving time off in lieu, TOIL, pay for accrued TOIL on termination? This is going to come down to the three following points. Number one, is the practice of giving TOIL addressed in the contract of employment or in a formal TOIL policy? Number two, if it isn't addressed in the contract or policy, has there been a variation to the contract? And number three, if TOIL isn't addressed in the contract or policy and there has been no variation, can a contractual term be implied through custom and practice? So looking at point number one first, if the contract or policy allows for TOIL, it should also address whether TOIL can be paid in lieu on termination. In many cases, TOIL policies will specify that employees are not allowed to build up TOIL time beyond a certain number of days, or TOIL must be taken within a set time period, or that any outstanding TOIL should be taken during any period of notice. If the employee has outstanding TOIL at the point of termination, the employer should ascertain whether that TOIL time has remained untaken as a result of a breach of the established TOIL practices. For instance, if an employee, knowing they intend to resign, has allowed TOIL to build up in the hopes of receiving a nice payout when they leave, but in doing so they've acted in breach of the established policies, then the employer would be justified in refusing to pay the TOIL on termination. However, if the contract or policy allows for TOIL but is silent on how much TOIL can be built up or the time frame in which it should be taken, then it's likely that the employer will be obligated to pay for the accrued TOIL on termination. If there's no written policy or contractual term regarding TOIL and whether or not it should be paid in lieu on termination, we should then look at the specific circumstances. Firstly, we should consider whether there's been an agreed variation. By way of an example, an employer running a toy shop who have no contractual term allowing TOIL might agree either orally in writing that employees who agree to work longer hours on a TOIL basis over the Christmas period, say November and December, will be able to receive that time back after the end of the January sales. Assume the employees agree to the proposal and work extra time on this understanding, this would act as a variation to their contract. If the employee then resigns before having been able to reclaim their TOIL, then clearly it would be appropriate for this TOIL to be paid. In this example, even if the employee has no evidence of this variation, the facts might suggest that an agreement would be probable, i.e. a number of staff members all suddenly working outside their normal working hours with no apparent increase in remuneration. Alternatively, if TOIL isn't specified in a contract or policy and there's no apparent variation, employers should consider whether allowing TOIL is an implied term, and if so, on what basis. By way of background, terms are implied into employment contracts by custom and practice if they're customary in a particular trade or locality or at a particular workplace. To constitute an implied term, a custom or practice must satisfy the common law test of being, firstly, reasonable, notorious, and certain, and secondly, followed with such regularity that it becomes legitimate to infer that the parties follow the practice because there's a sense of legal obligation to do so. In deciding whether or not a practice will amount to an implied term, a tribunal would look at the course of dealings between the parties and the subjective beliefs about what obligation they've entered into, which includes construing oral exchanges and conduct. Employees could seek to rely on an agreement on entire agreement clauses in the contract of employment to support an argument that the written contract contains the entire agreement between the parties and excludes terms that would otherwise be implied into the agreement. However, this will not prevent terms being implied into the contract if the contract doesn't apparently reflect the actual circumstances. So assuming the practice of actually taking toil is considered to be implied, an implied term through custom practice, the next step would be to look at how toil is taken in practice and whether there's also an implied term regarding the payment of toil on termination. As I mentioned earlier, it could be that the practice is that no more than one day's worth of toil can be taken, can be held in the toil bank at any one time, and or toil must be taken within the same month it's accrued or within the same pay period, for example. In such circumstances, it's extremely unlikely that payment of days or weeks of accrued toil on termination would be found to be an implied term. As I mentioned, in order for the payment of toil on termination to be an implied term, the practice of doing so must be reasonable, notorious, and certain, and followed with such regularity that it becomes legitimate to infer that the parties follow the practice because there's a sense of legal obligation to do so. That's a mouthful. Anyway, this would suggest that you look to the past. Do you usually pay any toil that's been accrued when people leave, or are they required to take it prior to departure, for instance, during a period of notice? If an employee can show that payment on departure is not the norm, then it would be difficult for an employee to argue it's an implied term. One point I would urge employers to be wary of is if a failure to pay toil would result in an employee being paid less than the national minimum wage. If this was the case, then it should be paid even if to do so would not be standard practice. If the toil was an implied term of the contract, and if the employee could establish that they should be paid for accrued toil on termination, then failure to make such payment would amount to a breach of contract and a claim could be possible. In addition, an employee could bring a claim for unlawful deduction of wages. Due to the potential issues that could arise, we would urge employers who have or are considering introducing practices of toil to make sure the basis on which the practice will be implemented is clear and it is in writing to avoid any confusion. I'll now pass you back to Catherine for our final question of the morning.
Thanks, Fiona. So the final question was about maternity cover and an applicant for a position on a fixed term basis. So in this situation, a verbal conditional offer is made for someone to cover maternity leave for a 12-month fixed term period. And the employer then finds out that the person they've offered the job to is herself pregnant and will only be available for a few months of that fixed term period. And the question is, can they now turn that candidate down? And then secondly, what are the risks? In terms of question one, can you turn the candidate down? In short, no. You can't withdraw a job offer if you discover a candidate is pregnant. And that is true no matter whether a role is fixed term or permanent. And even if it means, it, like in this situation, where the prospective that the candidate won't actually be able to fulfil the fixed term period that you want them to cover. Job applicants, along with employees and other individuals, are protected under the Equality Act from discrimination. And the particular issue here is under Section 18 of the Equality Act, it's unlawful for employers to unlawfully discriminate by treating a woman unfavourably during a protected period. Now, the protected period starts from the start of pregnancy through to the end of maternity leave period. So it's unfavourable treatment during that protected period because of her pregnancy. So that the risk here is substantial. If you decide to withdraw the offer, there'll be clear grounds for a claim there. Now, when you look at discrimination claims, the kind of remedies there are a few different ones, but the main one is going to be compensation and the one that we would ordinarily expect someone to be seeking in the employment tribunal. And when you're looking at compensation, there are two issues. You'd look at financial compensation, a bit like you would in an unfair dismissal claim. But the really important thing to note there is that there is no cap on the limit, as there is for unfair dismissal, where there is that limit at the statutory cap. So it's unlimited compensation potentially. And also the kind of things that you would take into account would be, you know, loss of salary, loss of pension, loss of other benefits. But it's also really important to note that for discrimination claims, another difference in comparison to unfair dismissal is that you can also claim for non-financial loss, and that's referred to as the injury to feeling award. You may well have heard, likely have heard of the Bento guidelines, and that's where the different types of compensation fall into the three bands. The lower band of £500 to £5,000, middle band for more serious cases, 5,000 to 15,000, and the top band, 15,000 to 25,000 for the most serious cases. So the risk there is substantial if you're taking that course of action, and serious in terms of potential financial loss, in terms of dealing with a tribunal claim, but also then if they're successful, which they would be, dealing with a compensation. Also in terms of reputational risk, you clear discrimination there under the Equality Act. In terms of an offer being made, it's also really important to note that if you've made that offer and it's been accepted and there is a contract, so all of the other requirements for a contract to be in place have been satisfied, then there will be a breach if you withdraw the offer, because a contract will be in place regardless of whether that's all been agreed verbally. So it doesn't need to be in writing. So you need to think of then other potential claims from a risk perspective. So there may be entitlement to notice, in terms of the entitlement under the contract, but also the right an automatic unfair dismissal claim. In terms of pregnancy and maternity, it's one of the situations where if you dismiss that reason, a dismissal would be automatically unfair, and the requirement for 2 years services does not stand as it would for an ordinarily unfair dismissal right. So it's important to be aware of those. And just on a final note, when you're going through the recruitment process, it's important to remember that an individual is not obliged to disclose any information about their pregnancy if they are pregnant. And also at the point at which, if someone does give you that information, you can't take that into account at all in your decision-making process as to whether you select them or you shortlist them for interview. So just an important point to note there. That's all the questions this week, so I'll pass you back to David. Thanks.
Thanks very much, both of you. Very quickly for me, just to sum up, as I usually say at this point, firms working really hard to produce and deliver relevant, useful content, articles, podcasts, blogs, videos, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And that includes all episodes of these Q&A sessions. You can also follow the employment team on Twitter at SintonsHR. If you'd like to discuss anything the guys have raised today further, please don't hesitate to get in touch with them or a member of the employment team. Details are on the screen. Our next session will be Friday the 26th of November at 10 a.m, and I'll, as usual, send the link round nearer the time. So from myself, from Fiona, from Catherine, thanks once again for tuning in. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you.